time, the New York Players kept true to the basic ethos of that music, especially its rhythms and syncopations, while incorporating a broad range of other devices, borrowed both from jazz players such as Jelly Roll Morton and Earl Hines, as well as from classical pianists. The result was a virtuosic, orchestral style of performance. James P. Johnson noted the origins of this style in the competitive musical environment of New York. The other sections of the country never developed the piano as far as the New York boys did. Only lately have they caught up. The reason the New York boys became such high-class musicians was because the New York piano was developed by the European method, system, and style. The people in New York were used to hearing good piano played in concerts and cafes. The ragtime player had to live up to that standard. They had to get orchestral effects, sound harmonies, chords, and all the techniques of European concert pianists who were playing their music all over the city. Johnson's own music epitomized this approach. It represents a critical link between the ragtime of Joplin and the jazz of Waller and Tatum. His early efforts remain true to the rag style, with his composition Carolina Shout gaining particular favor among his peers. The work was widely imitated by other players even before the sheet music was published, and eventually replaced the Maple Leaf Rag as the ultimate test piece for aspiring rag pianists. Johnson's works may have lacked the melodic inspiration and compositional balance that characterized Joplin's pieces, but he made up for it in the sheer breadth of his musical aspirations. His popular songs were great successes with If I Could Be With You 1 Hour Tonight, Old Fashioned Love, and Charleston, reaching a mass audience that was only vaguely familiar with a composer's jazz credentials. Yet Johnson also attacked the citadels of concert music with a determination akin to Joplin's. His legacy includes Harlem Symphony, American Symphonic Suite, based on W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues, Concerto Jazz Amine, a piano rhapsody, Yamacraw, performed at Carnegie Hall with Fats Waller as soloist, and the opera, De Organizer, boasting a libretto by Langston Hughes. Johnson received little encouragement during his lifetime for these efforts, and a posthumous search through his personal archives revealed numerous rejection letters from conductors and potential benefactors. Only sporadic performances in the years following Johnson's death in 1955 have saved these works from total obscurity. But Johnson's high aspirations for African-American music were a harbinger of later developments. In particular, Duke Ellington's more visionary projects, most notably Black, Brown, and Beige, and Harlem, are an outgrowth of, and may have been directly influenced by, the efforts of this ambitious predecessor. Even when he kept true to the stride idiom, Johnson was an inveterate experimenter who was willing to look outside the jazz and rag idiom for techniques he could apply to his compositions. These devices included classical interpolations. His repertoire included hot versions of the William Tell Overture and Peer Gynt, counterpoint exercises using national anthems. The final theme of his Imitator's Rag mixes Dixie in the right hand with the Star-Spangled Banner in the left, and much else besides. In later years, Johnson even adapted to the demands of jazz combo work, recording with the Blue Note Jazzmen and on a number of sides by prominent Chicago players. There may have been greater jazz musicians than James P. Johnson, but few artists of his day sensed so clearly the latent potential of African-American music or worked so vigorously to bring it into reality. Under the inspiration of Johnson and others, the world of stride piano developed a macho, competitive ethos that has since come to permeate the jazz world as a whole. This overlay of artistry and combat remains an important and often overlooked tradition in African-American culture. Duke Ellington, recalling his own schooling in the Harlem stride piano tradition, explained, "Anybody who had a reputation as a piano player had to prove it right there and then by sitting down to the piano and displaying his artistic wares." In later years, the cutting contest, a jam session in which outplaying the other participants, cutting them in jazz jargon, became an important part of jazz pedagogy and practice, and the most crucial rite of passage for a young player. Its overtones now hover over even the friendliest of jazz encounters. In an age in which other art forms have come to eschew demonstrations of virtuosity, the jazz world continues to embrace one-upmanship and displays of technique as an integral part of its culture. To a great extent, the hothouse environment of Harlem helped to produce this new image of the jazz musician as half-artist, half-warrior. Willie the Lion Smith epitomized this new breed of jazz player. His reputation in the jazz world was made not in concert halls or clubs, but in back rooms and private gatherings. Asserting his supremacy among the assembled piano players was the core value of his musicality. Ellington called him a gladiator at heart. Smith's attitude to lesser talents was anything but tolerant. Ellington describes the Lion's typical response to these ill-suited aspirants to his throne. Before he got through too many stanzas, the Lion was standing over him, cigar blazing. Like, if the cat was weak with the left hand, the Lion would say, "What's the matter? Are you a cripple?" Or, "When did you break your left arm?" Or, "Get up, I will show you how it's supposed to go." Smith's swagger was as much a part of his reputation as his playing. When Willie Smith walked into a place, James P. Johnson explained, his every move was a picture, studied, practiced, and developed just like it was a complicated piano piece. Nat Hentoff likened the Lion's stroll to the keyboard to Don Juan on the way to an assignation. Smith met formidable competitors in the night spots and rent parties where Harlem's stride evolved. In addition to Johnson, these late-night sessions might feature any one of a number of keyboard protagonists. Taken as a whole, they form a cast of characters worthy of a Damon Runyon novel. Lucky Roberts had worked as a child acrobat before becoming a professional pianist, and brought a flair for dramatic pyrotechnics with him to the keyboard. His massive hands could span a 14th, and his octaves and tremolos were the envy of his peers. Little is known about stride player Abba Laba, but his powerful left hand and predilection for sophisticated harmonic substitutions may have prefigured the later work of Art Tatum. Another mysterious stride master, known simply as Seminole, was a formidable southpaw. In his autobiography, Count Basie recalls losing a cutting contest to him, lamenting, "He had a left hand like everybody else had a right hand, and he dethroned me, took my crown." Donald Lambert spent only 4 years in Harlem, but though he was nicknamed the Lamb, he was more than ready to match up with the Lion at piano battles. "I believe this performance is technically impossible," Ethan Iverson, a historian of the keyboard as well as a skilled practitioner himself with his trio, The Bad Plus, has quipped with regard to Lambert's rendition of Anitra's Dance. But a surviving video testifies to Lambert's ability to play it with just his two hands and no assistance from the audience. Ubi Blake, a songwriter and raconteur as well as a noted pianist, was another charismatic exponent of the new style. Earl Hines recalls Blake, during this era, sporting a raccoon coat and derby, and always carrying a cane to enhance his stage presence, even when no stage was in sight. But Blake saved his best effects for the piano, where he would lift his hands high in theatrical fashion, sometimes conducting with one while continuing to pound the keys with the other. Blake lived to celebrate his 100th birthday, although official documents only give him credit for 96 years at his death in 1983. But by any measure, he spent more than 80 of them earning his living in the music industry, entertaining audiences with a keyboard style that combined a sure sense of ragged syncopation with a sensitivity to the melodic possibilities of popular music. Yet Thomas Fats Waller did more than any of these players to bring the Harlem style to the attention of the broader American public. Born in Harlem on May 21, 1904, Waller honed his skills by drawing on the full range of opportunities that New York City could provide. His teachers included two great local institutions, Juilliard and James P. Johnson, as well as much in between. His early performance venues were equally diverse, reflecting Waller's adaptability to a gamut of settings, from the sacred to the profane. He was heard at religious services, where his father, a Baptist lay preacher, presided, at Harlem's Lincoln Theater, where he accompanied silent movies on the pipe organ, at rent parties and cabarets, literally everywhere and anywhere a keyboard might be at hand. His pristine piano tone and technical assurance could well have distinguished him even in symphonic settings, yet these considerable skills as an instrumentalist were eventually overshadowed by Waller's other talents. While still in his teens, Waller initiated his career as a songwriter, and over the next two decades he would produce a number of successful compositions, many of which remain jazz standards, including Ain't Misbehavin', Honeysuckle Rose, Squeeze Me, and Jitterbug Waltz. In time, Waller's comedic abilities and engaging stage persona would add further momentum to his career, pointing to a range of further opportunities, only some of which he lived to realize. Waller's reputation in the jazz world rests primarily on his many boisterous performances and recordings, the latter comprising around 600 tracks made over a 20-year period. With unflagging exuberance, Waller talked, sang, joked, exhorted band members, and, almost as an afterthought, played the piano on these memorable sides. At times, they sound more like a party veering out of control than a recording session. Indeed, this was the quintessential party music for those who had come of age under Prohibition, a time when the most festive soirees were, by definition, illicit. Waller was skilled at playing Falstaff to this generation, hinting at speakeasy enticements with a wink of the eye, a telling quip, or other intimations of immorality. True, a cavalier aesthetic has always dominated jazz, celebrating the eternal in the most intense aspects of the here and now. Do we expect anything less from an art form built on improvisation? But few artists pushed this attitude to the extremes that Waller did, and audiences loved it. With a winning, warm demeanor, Waller made them feel like they were honored guests at his party, drinking from the best bottle in the house, privy to the wittiest asides, and seated front row center to hear the band. Although Waller's small combo work captured the public's imagination, his solo keyboard performances, documented on a handful of recordings and player piano rolls, remain his most poised statements as a jazz artist. Familiar stride piano elements, an oompa left hand coupled with syncopated right hand figures, serve as the building blocks of his playing here. But Waller leavens them with a compositional ingenuity that raises them above the work of his peers. Waller's solo work reveals his omnivorous musical appetite, drawing on the blues, hear the majestic slow blues in Numb Fumblin', classical music, evoked for instance in the high register figures of African Ripples, and Boogie Woogie, note its ingenious interpolation in the opening phrase of Alligator Crawl, as well as the ragtime roots of the music, as in Handful of Keys and Smashing Thirds. On Viper's Drag, Waller toys with a contrast between an ominous dark opening theme in a minor key and a swinging major mode section, a device Ellington used frequently during this same period in crafting his own version of Harlem Jazz. Combining his talents as a pianist and his sense of compositional balance, Waller's solo works stand out as the high point of the Harlem stride tradition. While most other jazz musicians of his generation gravitated toward the big bands in the 1930s and 1940s, Waller cultivated other ambitions. His activities took him anywhere and everywhere the entertainment industry flourished, from the theaters of Broadway to the motion picture studios of Hollywood. Even when he confined his attentions to music, Waller's restless seeking after new challenges was ever apparent. In a half-dozen areas, as pianist, organist, vocalist, songwriter, bandleader, and sideman, he made a mark that is still felt in the worlds of jazz and popular music. His successes of the pre-war years were topped by a well-received 1938 European tour. In Scotland, wearing a Glengarry tartan, he dazzled the audience with a Harlem Stride reworking of Loch Lomond, and was brought back for 10 curtain calls. The following year he returned to England, where he worked on a grand scale, composing and recording his London Suite, comprising 6 piano sketches. Back in the States, he performed and recorded prolifically and undertook a range of new projects. In 1943, Waller managed to write the music for the stage show Early to Bed, tour extensively, and travel to Hollywood to co-star in the film Stormy Weather, along with Lena Horne, Cab Calloway, and Bill Bojangles Robinson. The strain of pursuing these multiple careers may have been too much. On December 15, 1943, Waller died of pneumonia while on a cross-country train trip back to New York. At the time of his passing, he was at the peak of his popularity. Had he lived, Waller would no doubt have built on his early forays into radio and movies and would have been a natural for the medium of television. Around this same time, another vernacular form of African-American keyboard music was making a mark on American popular tastes. Boogie Woogie, as this style was called, first came to the attention of the music industry in the 1920s, but achieved its greatest popularity in the early 1940s, when the faddish sound served as the basis for a number of hit records. This musical idiom combined insistent left-hand patterns based on blues chord progressions with syncopated melody lines or block chords in the right hand. The style demanded exceptional hand independence and a sure sense of time from the performer. The term boogie-woogie first came into use in the late 1920s, although the roots of this style may date back to the late 19th century and might have originally applied to a dance that was accompanied by this boisterous piano music, implied, for example, in Pine Top Smith's spoken commentary on Pine Top's Boogie-Woogie from 1928. The style achieved its highest pitch as unaccompanied keyboard music, although it was not uncommon for pianists to perform together in duos and trios, as on Boogie Woogie Prayer, recorded by Mead Lux Lewis, Albert Ammons, and Pete Johnson. The leading practitioners occasionally tried their dexterous hands at other keyboard styles, but for the most part, Boogie Woogie remained a fringe music, lingering in the interstices between blues and jazz. For a brief spell, mainstream performers embraced it, as demonstrated by Tommy Dorsey in Boogie Woogie, 1938, Count Basie in Basie Boogie, 1941, and the Andrews Sisters in Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, 1941. More authentic examples of the idiom can be found in such recordings as Mead Lux Lewis's Honky Tonk Train Blues and Albert Ammons's Shout for Joy. Historians of these and other early 20th century piano styles, Harlem Stride, Boogie Woogie, and other strands of jazz and popular keyboard music, face their greatest challenge in trying to place the genre-crossing and genre-busting artist Art Tatum, whose work from the early 1930s through the mid-1950s seemed to set its own rules and follow its own evolutionary schemas. He stands out as the greatest virtuoso in the Harlem Stride piano tradition, and also demonstrated his mastery on many occasions of Boogie Woogie. Yet he also did much more. As such, he remains a complex and controversial figure, one difficult to situate with any real precision in the stylistic pigeonholes commonly used in histories of modern American music. One invariably ends up reaching for the oldest cliché of them all, simply asserting that Tatum was ahead of his time. Yet it is equally valid to see Tatum as obsessed with the achievements of the past, not just in jazz but also in classical music, given the bravura Liszt-ian aspects of his playing. Certainly, Tatum's vision of jazz music was initially inspired by the Harlem Stride tradition, and though he stayed true to many of its mannerisms and devices until the end of his career, he more often than not subverted these self-same conventions, tore them apart, and used them piecemeal in building his own grandiloquent conception of jazz piano. For Tatum, Harlem Stride served as a foundation on which more complex musical superstructures could be built, just as medieval Christians often constructed cathedrals on the sites of pagan shrines. And though some might suggest that Art Tatum represented the finest flowering of the Harlem Stride tradition, in point of fact, he rang its death knell. In developing his mature style, Tatum all but exhausted the possibilities of Stride, forcing later piano modernists, Monk, Powell, Tristano, Brubeck, Evans, and others, to veer off into far different directions in an attempt to work their way outside the massive shadow of this imposing figure. Because of this, much of the musical vocabulary developed by Tatum remains unassimilated by later jazz pianists. Long after the phraseology of such later jazz masters as Charlie Parker and John Coltrane has been widely imitated and mastered, Tatum's legacy still sits in probate, waiting for a new generation of pianists to lay claim to its many riches. Tatum's virtuosity clouds the issue of his role in the history of jazz. Although his music has been by turns lauded and attacked for its showmanship and often gratuitous displays of technique, Tatum's importance is as much due to his advanced musical conception as to his agile fingers. True, no other jazz pianist of his generation, or later ones for that matter, could equal the speed and clarity of his execution, but equally compelling are the structural components of his playing. Employing massive chord voicings as building blocks, Tatum created dazzling harmonic variations and elevated passing chords, often compacted four to a bar, measure after measure, to a level of sophistication that has never been surpassed in either jazz or classical music. And though some of his techniques, abrupt modulations, rhythmic disjunctions, interpolations from concert hall pieces, had been employed by earlier players, none had incorporated them into the jazz idiom with the grace, ease, and creativity of Art Tatum. By the time he had completed his heroic task of recrafting the jazz keyboard vocabulary, he had taken the various hints and ideas that had existed earlier in the African-American tradition and mixed them with large doses of European classical music to form a systematic, all-encompassing vision of jazz piano. Tatum was born in Toledo, Ohio on October 13, 1909, far afield from Harlem and the other centers of jazz activity. Afflicted with cataracts in both eyes, Tatum underwent 13 operations in his youth, which eventually restored reasonable sight to one eye. But a blow to the head from an assailant, dating probably from the pianist's early 20s, undid much of the benefit of these procedures. For the rest of his life, Tatum enjoyed only partial sight in his right eye and remained totally blind in his left. But, as seems so often the case with blind musicians, Tatum compensated for his poor vision through a preternatural acuteness of ear. At age 3, he amazed his mother by picking out melodies on the piano that he had heard her sing at a choir rehearsal, and before long he was imitating jazz pieces learned from player pianos and radio broadcasts. Tatum's mother, as well as his teacher, Overton Rainey, of the Toledo School of Music, attempted to steer the youngster into a career in classical music. But though Tatum showed an extraordinary talent for playing the concert hall repertoire, his attraction to jazz eventually proved decisive. At age 16, he began working in and around Toledo, and by his late teens he was performing on a local radio station. Word of mouth had brought news of Tatum's piano prowess to other parts of the jazz world. Still, the Harlem musicians were not prepared for the impact that Tatum made when he traveled to New York as an accompanist to singer Adelaide Hall in 1932. Within days of his arrival, the local piano titans had decided to test the mettle of the newcomer from Toledo. Tatum found himself escorted to a Harlem night spot where the greatest masters of stride, including Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, and Willie the Lion Smith, were ready to do battle. When it came Tatum's time to play, he let loose with a dazzling T for two full of dense harmonies and sweeping runs and arpeggios that left the audience speechless. James P. Johnson gamely followed with his Carolina Shout, and Waller checked in with his handful of keys, but Tatum responded with a virtuoso version of Tiger Rag, taken at a breakneck tempo that made comparisons pointless. Johnson returned to the keyboard with a final fiery rendition of Chopin's Revolutionary Etude, and though Waller later said he had never heard this elder statesman of stride play quite so well, the final verdict was no longer in doubt. "That Tatum, he was just too good," Waller later recollected. "He had too much technique. When that man turns on the powerhouse, don't no one play him down. He sounds like a brass band." James P. Johnson, for his part, later mused, "When Tatum played T for Two that night, I guess that was the first time I ever really heard it played." Several months later, Tatum made his first records, which included the two showpieces he had performed at that Harlem cutting contest. In later years, Tatum expanded his range of pianistic devices and became even more daring harmonically. But for the most part, these early recordings reveal a style almost fully formed, at least from the standpoint of technique and showmanship. Over the next 3 decades, Tatum recorded frequently, laying down over 600 tracks as soloist or bandleader. Despite the many virtues of Tatum's music from the 1930s and 1940s, he remains best known for a massive recording project made under the supervision of producer Norman Granz and completed toward the close of the pianist's career. Between December 1953 and September 1956, Tatum recorded over 200 numbers for Granz, most done in a single take during marathon sessions. This body of work features Tatum both as a soloist and in collaborations with other jazz masters, including especially successful pairings with Ben Webster and Roy Eldridge. These late recordings reveal a mature, secure artist playing at near peak level. Somewhat less elegant but more viscerally exciting are the handful of live performances that Tatum left behind. Informal sessions recorded in the early 1940s by Jerry Newman, a Columbia University graduate student at the time, showcase Tatum in a looser, uninhibited mood at various Harlem night spots, playing, accompanying, even singing the blues. These majestic performances, both playful and awe-inspiring, give credence to the view that Tatum was at his best when playing after hours. Also worth noting is Tatum's Shrine Auditorium concert from 1949, where the pianist's astonishing double-time work on I Know That You Know, at a tempo well over 400 beats per minute, his titanic Gershwin melody, and the sly dissonances of the Carey Dance hint at the broad range of his musical imagination. In November 1956, a short while after completing the recording project instigated by Granz, Tatum died in Los Angeles from uremia at age 47. Tatum's work, for all its virtues, was not above reproach. In some respects, he stands out as one of the most controversial figures in the history of the music, with supporters and detractors much at odds. French critic André Audier, in a celebrated attack, lamented the limitations of Tatum's repertoire, built, he asserted, on sentimental ballads and popular hits. His preference for embellishing the melody of a song rather than constructing original improvisations, as well as Tatum's over-reliance on arpeggios, scales, and other keyboard flourishes. Gunter Schuller, in his 1989 study, The Swing Era, amplifies on Audier's points, describing Tatum's work as predictable and highly derivative. The entire range of Tatum's virtuosic skills, including his lightning-fast arpeggios and runs, are set forth in the middle to late 19th century piano literature. It is simply untrue that Tatum created his arabesque virtuoso technique out of the blue. These criticisms are not without validity, but they need to be placed in context. First, with regard to repertoire, jazz fans are certainly justified in lamenting that Tatum did not focus more attention on original compositions and ambitious large-scale projects. Yet how can one fault Tatum's reliance on the great popular songwriters of his time? Drawing almost entirely on the masterpieces of his contemporaries, which included George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, Richard Rodgers, Harold Arlen, Duke Ellington, and others, Tatum consistently featured the finest songs of his day, indeed of his century, oftentimes recognizing them long before they had become standards. On his first record session, Tatum performed Sophisticated Lady, although Ellington's own debut recording of the piece was literally only a few weeks old at the time. As for Tatum's dependence on the virtuoso tricks of 19th century classical music, a similarly equivocal response must be made. True, the superficial piano pyrotechnics may be derivative, but where is the 19th century equivalent of Tatum's inspired passing chord reharmonizations, sometimes seasoned with hints of bitonality and playful dissonances, and executed with rapid-fire precision? Or of his rhythmic explosions in which the groundbeat is eclipsed by a dizzying two-handed cannonade of notes? Or of his syncopated stride eruptions, which push the metronome settings to hitherto unknown levels? Within the annals of classical music, there is no equivalent, and although jazz historians can trace the roots of some of these techniques to Hines, Waller, and others, Tatum elevates them to a level of brilliance not found in the original sources. As to Tatum's delight in ornamenting the melody of a piece, one is as justified in praising as in critiquing these reworkings of the original songs, given the ingenuity and inexhaustible variety Tatum brings to the task. Finally, the complaint that Tatum did not improvise but merely played set pieces must be dismissed by anyone who has listened to his many recordings, especially those made in informal settings, where Tatum was often at his best and invariably at his most daring. In truth, the closer one gets to the core of Tatum's music and away from the surface activity, the more original it sounds. The strongest validation of this comes not from jazz critics, but from the musicians themselves, who are anything but ambiguous on this account. A survey of musicians conducted in 1956 by Leonard Feather for his Encyclopedia of Jazz found a stunning 68% of them citing Tatum as the preeminent jazz pianist. A 1985 survey of jazz pianists conducted by Gene Lees again placed Tatum comfortably on top, suggesting that despite the passing of almost three decades, changing tastes, and the emergence of many new masters of the keyboard, Tatum had lost none of his power to astonish and inspire, and often to dismay other practitioners of the art. The birth of the big band. The emergence of the big band idiom, with its subtle interweaving of four sections, saxophone, trumpet, trombone, and rhythm, may seem, with the benefit of hindsight, an inevitable development in the evolution of jazz music. Was it not some law of aesthetic Darwinism that forced the rough-and-ready small combos of early jazz to give way to the more robust and polished orchestras of Ellington and Goodman? Not really. The connecting line between the roots of jazz and the later big band sound is far from direct or clear. During the so-called jazz age, most of the music's key exponents focused their creative energy on soloing, not band leading, on improvisation, not orchestration, on an interplay between individual instruments, not between sections. The move to a more compositionally oriented idiom of dance music, under the rubric of big band jazz, was anything but smooth or obvious at the time. Commercial pressures rather than artistic prerogatives stand out as the spur that forced many early jazz players, including Armstrong, Beiderbecke, and Hines, to embrace the big band idiom. But even in the new setting, they remained improvisers first and foremost, not orchestrators or composers. A different body of individuals with different talents and inclinations, Don Redmond, Fletcher Henderson, Duke Ellington, Ferdy Grofe, Benny Carter, Bill Challis, Art Hickman, and others, would be required to decipher the artistic implications in this shift in the public's taste, to comprehend it as a guidepost pointing to a truly revolutionary, rather than evolutionary, change in the sound of American band music. As in so many other aspects of the history of jazz, the intermingling of musical genres played a critical role in shaping a new idiom, and New York served as the crucible in which this fusion of styles took place. As early as 1915, the original Creole Orchestra, featuring Freddie Keppard, performed in New York. Its success paved the way for the more celebrated visit of the original Dixieland Jazz Band in 1917. By the close of World War I, the influence of these jazz ensembles could be heard throughout the city at vaudeville shows, theaters, society dances, restaurants, and cabarets. Indeed, almost anywhere live music was performed. The jazz idiom in this setting was already revealing its omnivorous diet, a trait we will witness repeatedly in the course of this history, and was foraging now in Tin Pan Alley, Broadway, and wherever else a fertile musical environment could be found. It could digest other musical styles in whole or in part, all the while maintaining its distinctive characteristics. Certainly this quality, more than any other, proved decisive in the development of that distinctively American orchestra, the jazz big band. The recorded work of James Rhys Europ reflects the degree to which syncopation had entered the dance orchestra vocabulary even before the 1920s. In 1912, Europ brought an African-American orchestra into Carnegie Hall for a celebrated performance, silencing the naysayers, including Will Marion Cook, who predicted that the concert would be a fiasco that would set the Negro race back 50 years. But the event proved to be a huge success, and Europ returned for follow-up performances in 1913 and 1914. Europ would exert even more influence through his society orchestra's accompaniment of the celebrated dance team of Irene and Vernon Castle, who established the foxtrot as a dance sensation. A short while later, Europ formed a military band that played a key role in popularizing African-American music among overseas audiences. Despite these substantial achievements, it would be going too far to see James Rhys Europ as the originator of the jazz big band style. With its ponderous sound, which relied heavily on unison voicings, and its lack of improvisational fire, Europe's society orchestra stood out as a late flowering of the ragtime idiom, rather than as a harbinger of the jazz age. Nonetheless, the role of the Europe ensemble in supporting new popular dance styles was indicative of an important change in American tastes, and one that anticipated the later evolution of big band jazz. In the years before 1910, mainstream social dancing in America had relied primarily on European-influenced waltzes, galops, polkas, jigs, quadrilles, and the like, with only occasional crossover dances, such as the cakewalk, coming from African-American culture. But by 1914, new and different dance steps were gaining widespread popularity, so much so that the Vatican felt compelled that year to publicly denounce the turkey trot and the tango. Building off the musical support of James Rhys Europ, the Castles incorporated elements of different vernacular dances into their polished performances, creating a jazzier, less refined style that rapidly gained the favor of East Coast society. Through their exhibitions and their New York school, they served as an important link between African-American dance and white society. Histories of jazz often overlook the critical role these shifting currents in social dancing exerted on the music. The changing nature of the jazz orchestra in New York during the years following the Castle Europ collaboration was, in many ways, dictated from the dance floor as much as from the bandstand. Fletcher Henderson, who helped define the emerging jazz big band sound in the 1920s, also drew inspiration not just from New Orleans and Chicago jazz, but even more from these currents of popular music and dance that were sweeping New York in those years. Ethel Waters, in a telling anecdote, described how she had to force Henderson to listen to player piano rolls so that he could understand how to accompany her properly on a blues recording. Henderson was a quick study and eventually made extensive use of the blues in his music, but initially it was the ethos of the ballrooms, of Tin Pan Alley, of Broadway and vaudeville, as well as the rag bands of the Northeast, that set the context for his dramatic reconstruction of the American jazz orchestra. In truth, by both temperament and training, Henderson was an unlikely jazz innovator. Born in Cuthbert, Georgia in 1897, Fletcher Henderson was raised in a middle-class black family where European concert music, not rags and blues, was considered an indispensable part of a youngster's education. He went on to take a degree in chemistry and mathematics at Atlanta University, and his decision to move to New York was ostensibly motivated by his desire to find a job as a chemist. With his reserved and unassuming demeanor, Henderson made little headway in chemistry, and soon found himself demonstrating songs, at $22.50 per week, for the Pace Handy Music Company, a black-owned publishing house of the day, an involvement that eventually led to Henderson's role organizing studio sessions for Harry Pace's Black Swan record label. Hiring and performing in various studio groups, Henderson had found a way to make a living, but still might never have parlayed this opportunity into a full-time career as a bandleader had his sidemen not talked him into auditioning for an opening for a dance orchestra at the Club Alabama on West 44th Street. He secured the Alabama gig, which soon led to a more visible engagement at Roseland, then in the process of becoming the most important ballroom in New York, if not the whole country. For the next decade, Henderson used this venue as his home base, as he developed a new, progressive jazz vocabulary in synergistic relationship with the popular dance styles of the day. Henderson has often been criticized for his supposed inability, whether due to indifference or diffidence, to assume the leadership responsibilities that would have given his orchestra the public success it so richly deserved. In this regard, Henderson is typically compared to Duke Ellington, whose gift as a leader of musicians may have been as great as his instrumental acumen, or to Benny Goodman, who some years later would use Henderson's arrangements as a building block in his own much greater popular acclaim. Yet, if Henderson lacked the interpersonal skills necessary to run a band, one could hardly tell it by looking at the roster of musicians he attracted to his orchestra. Even Ellington, despite all his genius for eliciting the most from his eccentric group of players, pales in comparison to Henderson in this arena. Henderson's reed section featured, for greater or lesser stints, Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Ben Webster, Chu Berry, and Benny Carter. One could plausibly argue that these were the five greatest saxophonists of their day. His brass players during these years included Louis Armstrong, Roy Eldridge, Henry Red Allen, Rex Stewart, Tommy Ladner, Dickie Wells, J.C. Higginbotham, Joe Smith, Benny Morton, and Jimmy Harrison. Has any other jazz bandleader of any era, even a Miles Davis, a Count Basie, an Art Blakey, or a Benny Goodman, been able to boast of a more illustrious set of alumni? Yet the most powerful influence on the band came from none of these sources. More than any of these justly celebrated musicians, Don Redman served as a key force in transforming this working dance band into an influential link between the jazz age and the swing era. Without Redman, the Henderson Orchestra might have remained a finishing school for talented soloists, but under his influence it became something more, the birthplace of a new jazz sound and a repository for an emerging aesthetic. Like Henderson, Redman was a college-educated Southerner who had found steady employment in the burgeoning New York jazz scene. In his native West Virginia, where he was born in 1900, Redman had garnered attention as a child prodigy who easily mastered the rudiments of a wide range of instruments, versatility that held him in good stead when he later undertook the blending of these different textures in his path-breaking arrangements. In his early 20s, Redman went on the road with Billy Page's Broadway Syncopators, playing clarinet and saxophones in addition to writing band charts. This affiliation brought Redman to New York, where he met Henderson. Their collaboration began at studio sessions even before the formation of the Henderson Orchestra. When the Roseland gig became available, Redman was enlisted to join the band. Coleman Hawkins, destined to mature into one of the most important soloists in the history of jazz, was also present with the Henderson Ensemble virtually from the start. The similarities in background between Hawkins, Redman, and Henderson are striking. Like the others, Hawkins was a newcomer to the Northeast. He was born in St. Joseph, Missouri on November 21, 1904, and had already pursued a musical education in an academic setting. Perhaps informally, his official attendance at Washburn College, where he claimed to have studied harmony and composition, is not substantiated by school records. But the shared personality traits are even more striking than these biographical details. Diffident, professional, soft-spoken, worldly, disciplined, well-trained, fascinated by progressive trends in music, these qualities marked each of the three. Do we see here the emergence of a new type of jazz musician? Biterbeck, the high school dropout who could barely read music, Armstrong, the juvenile delinquent who refined his native talent at the Waifs' home, these personality types, so indicative of the pioneers of New Orleans and Chicago, were now to be replaced by a new breed of player, the professional big band instrumentalist. Here was the jazz equivalent of the organization man, and at this point in time, the Henderson Orchestra was the consummate organization. Hawkins learned piano at age 5 and took up cello 2 years later. For his 9th birthday, he received a saxophone, and by age 12 he was playing at school dances. In 1921, Hawkins went on the road with singer Mamie Smith, who 1 year earlier had achieved a huge success with Crazy Blues, a million-selling hit that initiated the craze for race records. Smith provided Hawkins with a number of opportunities to perform in front of large crowds, to initiate his recording career in May 1922, and to come to New York. But by the summer of 1923, Hawkins had left Smith and was recording with Henderson. While Redman did much of his work behind the scenes, crafting the band's arrangements, Hawkins stood out on the bandstand as the group's featured soloist, usually on tenor saxophone, but sometimes playing clarinet, C melody saxophone, baritone saxophone, or bass saxophone. Today, the saxophone is not only an accepted and popular band instrument, but to many listeners represents the quintessential sound of jazz. This was far from the case during the years in which Hawkins mastered his craft. The saxophone family was still in its infancy, virtually unknown in the symphonic world, and relegated primarily to military bands. The Belgian instrument maker Antoine Joseph Adolphe Sax had patented the horn in Paris in 1846. But Sax, despite his zeal for invention, his inspirations also included the sax horn, sax tuba, saxo tromba, and even the saxo cannon, his neglected contribution to the Crimean War campaign, gained little financial benefit from his efforts, and died in poverty in 1894. But the intrinsic advantages of his most famous instrument, it was easy to learn, forgiving in its tone production and relatively inexpensive to make with its simple metal body attached to a conventional clarinet-type mouthpiece, proved decisive in the long run. By the early years of the 20th century, the saxophone had established itself as an important instrumental voice, first in military bands and later in popular and jazz ensembles. The only thing lacking was a tradition and an accepted body of playing techniques. This was provided in large part by Hawkins. Certainly there had been earlier jazz saxophonists. Hawkins himself was quick to give credit to largely forgotten figures such as Stump Evans, Prince Robinson, and Happy Caldwell. And Sidney Bechet, as we have seen, had also made important early contributions to the saxophone tradition in jazz. Even so, at the start of Hawkins's career, the saxophone had yet to match the role of the cornet or clarinet as an important jazz solo voice. Years later, many devotees of New Orleans style would grumble that the death knell for pure jazz was sounded when the saxophonists took over the music. Blame Mr. Hawkins for that palace coup. In particular, the tenor saxophone held an especially insignificant role in jazz before Hawkins's influential advocacy. Rudy Videft had recorded on the C melody saxophone as early as 1916, while Frank Trumbauer's later work on the instrument was also very influential in its day. Given these predecessors, as well as the rich clarinet tradition in New Orleans and Chicago bands, few would have predicted at the time that the tenor would become the dominant saxophone voice in jazz. Indeed, even Hawkins had begun by playing the C melody sax. Without his later championing of the tenor with its heavier and more dominating presence, the later evolution of the jazz reed tradition might have unfolded far differently. Yet Hawkins's impact extended even more to the sound and fury of the tenor, not merely its selection as a jazz instrument. This was an important achievement. Prior to Hawkins, the saxophone's versatility and the absence of role models from classical music were as much a curse as a blessing. For better or worse, the tenor sax lacked a correct sound, an accepted way of tone production. Whinnying noises, smears, slap-tonguing, barks, growls, novelty effects, the strangest assortment of sounds were all part of the shared vocabulary of the pre-Hawkins saxophone idiom. In the wake of the first generation of clarinet and C melody sax players, the reed tradition in jazz had favored a lighter sound, with a greater emphasis on ornamentation and patterns than on robust push-the-band improvisation. But by the time Hawkins had finished his redefinition of the instrument, a streamlined jazz tenor sax sound had been forged, one that remained dominant for the next 40 years and retains considerable influence to this day. For good reason, he is often lauded as the father of tenor sax. Even with Redman and Hawkins on board, the earliest recordings of Henderson's band are lackluster. The arrangements are simple, sticking close to the model set by King Oliver, whose influence looms large on these sides, and the other New Orleans pioneers, while the improvised sections of the music are often repetitive and unimaginative, with only an occasional phrase or hot break to indicate the potential of the band soloists. But in the months following Henderson's opening at the Club Alabama, a number of changes can be heard. The band adds more players. Its sound gets denser and more complex. The performances become tighter and more focused. The group still has not abandoned its allegiance to formulas associated with New Orleans jazz, especially in terms of rhythmic conception and solo construction, but already the barest indications of a different paradigm, more arranged, more harmonically sophisticated, can be heard in incipient form. And even the lingering influence of the New Orleans style was not without its value in this new setting. A perspicacious listener can hear the later battling exchanges of sections in a jazz big band anticipated in the dueling counterpoint of individual horns in the traditional jazz of Oliver and other Crescent City pioneers. More than any other event, Henderson's hiring of Louis Armstrong in 1924 served as a catalyst in accelerating the band's evolution. Comparisons of Armstrong's solo work with Hawkins's on performances from 1924 and 1925, such as Money Blues, Go Long Mule, How Come You Do Me Like You Do, or Carolina Stomp, show how much the cornetist had to teach, and equally, how much the saxophonist still had to learn. In this setting, Hawkins gradually softened the rough edges of his phrasing and smoothed out the rhythmic flow of his playing. By the time of his influential performance on The Stampede from the spring of 1926, Hawkins was showing the first glimmerings of the self-assurance and fluidity that would distinguish his mature work. Hawkins was only 21 years old at the time, but this recording already served to generate a great deal of interest among his contemporaries. And not only with reed players. Trumpeter Roy Eldridge learned this solo note for note and played it at an early audition. However, the finishing touches on Hawkins's musical education would come 3 years later when the saxophonist heard Art Tatum during a Henderson road trip through Ohio. Inspired by this chance encounter, Hawkins further reconfigured his approach to the horn, incorporating harmonic concepts learned from the pianist. Don Redman's growth during this period is, if anything, even more remarkable. Yet his was the type of progress marked by continual refinement and steady improvement rather than overnight breakthroughs. Even before Redman, the more savvy dance bandleaders had drawn on jazz elements in crafting their arrangements. Art Hickman's San Francisco-based dance band, which came to New York in 1919, attracted attention for its use of saxophone section playing, while Paul Whiteman could count on Bill Challis, Matty Melnick, Tom Satterfield, and Ferdy Groffé, who had earlier worked for Hickman, to provide forward-looking jazz-oriented charts. Meanwhile, other bandleaders such as Vincent Lopez and Paul Specht were tapping into the growing demand for a more polished, high-society type of jazz orchestra. Yet the hotter, more potent style crafted slowly and painstakingly by Redman during these years would come to exert the most direct and decisive influence on the evolution of the jazz big band. Redman's arrangement of Dictee Blues, from the summer of 1923, already captures the essential quality of the new style, namely, the grouping of reed and brass instruments into separate sections and their use as foils for each other. Over the next several years, Redman and Henderson would explore a wider and wider range of techniques that built on this simple principle. Interweaving, dueling, engaging in call-and-response forms, alternating between supporting and dominant roles, sometimes combining in thickly textured block chords, these varied possibilities of section writing are now taken for granted by jazz listeners, and in many instances have become overworked clichés. But in these early days of the Henderson Band, they cut through the tired formulas of New Orleans and Chicago jazz, which had relied almost exclusively on contrasting monophonic voices, and presented a new building block for jazz, the section, rather than the instrumentalist. Locking together with the precision and discipline of military regiments on an advance, the combined sections could achieve musical results far beyond the scope of the earlier small combos. The nature of the sections also evolved with the passage of time. Clarinet trios may have been used before in vaudeville shows and suite bands, but they took on a new energy when pitted against brass trios in the Henderson Band. Yet this innovation proved to be only a starting point. The use of saxophones, less shrill than the clarinets and better suited for articulating rich mid and lower range harmonies, gradually emerged as the dominant force in the reed section. Brass trios grew into whole brass sections that could subdivide into separate trumpet and trombone units, each able to work separately or in conjunction with the other. The rhythm instruments also began taking shape as a separate section. Piano, tuba, later replaced by the string bass, drums, banjo, later replaced by guitar, their roles within the group became more specialized, more focused on linking together, providing rhythmic momentum for the band, and a sonic cushion for section work and solos. Armstrong's greatest impact may have been on the rhythmic component of Redman's chart writing. A more supple sense of timing begins to appear in his arrangements during this period. They become hotter, more syncopated. Plodding on-the-beat phrases are replaced by more vibrant excursions, reflecting in the written parts the same dynamism that distinguished Armstrong's ad-lib horn lines. The symphonic jazz aspirations of Whiteman, an early model for Redman, slowly give way to a different standard in which the hot solo provides the raw material for the arrangement. In an odd reversal of the classical tradition, written parts were now made to sound like improvisations, especially in their phrasing and fanciful use of melodic material. The only difference was that these solo-like lines were now fleshed out and given harmonic depth in the full-blown polyphony of the horn section. On this basis, a more fervent dialogue between the brass and reed sections takes root. With The Stampede, recorded shortly after Armstrong's departure from the band, this more insistent style of ensemble work is already noticeable. The textures behind the soloists are no longer passive harmonic cushions, but extroverted lines that propel the improvisation with incisive counterrhythms. The Henderson Stomp from November 1926 finds Redman experimenting with the structures of Harlem Stride. The performance features Fats Waller on piano, who also apparently wrote the composition, although it was copyrighted by Henderson, and tapping the inherently percussive and orchestral qualities of that idiom. By the time of Tozo, recorded in January 1927, Redman's style is almost fully formed. The written parts, with their assured command of polyrhythms and instrumental textures, are as compelling as the solos. With The Whiteman Stomp, from May 1927, Redman even delves into the avant-garde, crafting a highly eccentric orchestration in which fragments of musical shrapnel take flight unpredictably, coalescing into an odd type of jazz, one built on disjunction and entropy. That same year, half a world away, physicist Werner Heisenberg was articulating his famous uncertainty principle, the foundation for quantum physics. Here, Redman shows his allegiance to the same zeitgeist, espousing a jagged, pointillistic style in which all continuities are called into question. This piece, commissioned by Paul Whiteman, cannot be called a success, but it is a masterful failure, sounding like the jazz of some alternative universe, while demonstrating the extraordinary command of his medium that Redman had developed over the previous 4 years. This period also marks the close of Redman's formal ties with the Henderson Band. In 1927, he became musical director of McKinney's Cotton Pickers, an association that continued for the next several years. Although his new group lacked the extraordinary cadre of soloists that had distinguished the Henderson Ensemble, it featured two outstanding arrangers in Redman and John Nesbitt. Redman also figured prominently as a saxophone soloist and singer with the band. He left to form his own group in 1931. But during an era marked by a proliferation of big bands, this unit never succeeded in rising above the level of a second-tier ensemble, although it made numerous recordings and broadcasts and stayed together until 1941. Another group that drew heavily on the same personnel, the Chocolate Dandies, was never a working band, but left behind a handful of exciting recordings that marry Redman's arrangements with outstanding solo contributions from Coleman Hawkins, Benny Carter, Fats Waller, and others. These several settings allowed Redman to put together a body of work that firmly established him as a preeminent jazz orchestrator and innovator during the years preceding World War II. In the following two decades, Redman may not have remained at the cutting edge of the jazz world. Nonetheless, his charts continued to grace the bandstands of many important leaders, ranging from Count Basie to Pearl Bailey. His recorded output was negligible in his last years, but he continued to compose and left behind a number of extended pieces at his death in 1964 that have yet to be performed in public. Benny Carter, some 7 years younger than Redman, followed a similar career path, one that included affiliations, sometimes overlapping with Redman's, but more often following his departure, with Fletcher Henderson, McKinney's Cotton Pickers, and the Chocolate Dandies. And, like Redman, Carter eventually gravitated toward leading his own band. Talented, progressive, eager to learn and assimilate new techniques, Carter represented the best of the new generation of arrangers who were coming into their own at the close of the 1920s. Yet Carter's versatility as an instrumentalist has often served only to obscure his substantial contributions as an orchestrator and composer. This precocious young talent, born in New York on August 8, 1907, appeared to possess a telling knack for mastering each and every instrument in the band. Along with Johnny Hodges, Carter was a key figure in developing the alto saxophone as a major jazz voice, and his finest soloists on that instrument are as accomplished and musical as any of the era. But Carter's expertise also extended to the brass section. Here, for example, is trumpet work on Once Upon a Time from 1933, or his assurance in trading fours on trumpet against Coleman Hawkins' tenor on Pardon Me, Pretty Baby from 1937. Nor is that all. The previous year on You Understand, Carter fills in as pianist, while other recordings find him singing, playing the clarinet, tenor sax, trombone, or soprano sax. This dazzling array of onstage skills goes a long way toward explaining why Carter's behind-the-scenes efforts as an arranger often escape the attention of all but the most knowledgeable jazz fans. Band leaders, however, took notice almost from the start. Joining Henderson at roughly the same time that Redman departed, the 22-year-old Carter soon found that his writing skills were urgently needed by his new employer. Carter has described how, lacking formal training in orchestration, he learned on the job by analyzing and imitating stock arrangements. "You get down on your knees and study each part," he explained, "and then you start writing the lead trumpet first and the lead saxophone first, which of course is the hard way. It was quite some time that I did that before I knew what a score was." Yet Carter had soon not only assimilated the primitive techniques used in 1920 stock arranging, but also began building on the jazz scoring techniques of Bill Challis, Don Redmond, Archie Blyer, and others. As early as his 1930 arrangement of Keep a Song in Your Soul, Carter revealed a knack for scoring syncopated section work to rival Redmond's, and his block chord writing for four saxophones in Symphony and Riffs, Lonesome Nights, and Devil's Holiday from 1933 foreshadow a signature sound of the swing era. Carter always retained an instinctive feel for the lyrical possibilities of jazz in both his compositions and his playing. This sentimental Schubertian strain, more than anything else, stands as the defining element in Carter's musical personality and goes a long way toward explaining the lasting appeal of his work. Carter has sometimes cited Bill Challis and Frank Trumbauer as key influences, yet one suspects that his early listening not only encompassed jazz-oriented work, but extended to the sweet band music of the day. Certainly Carter's own writing displayed, almost from the start, a fascination with pretty sounds, soft nuances, and ruminative melodies. In a steady stream of works from the mid-1930s, Dream Lullaby, Nightfall, Lonesome Nights, Just a Mood, Lazy Afternoon, Once Upon a Time, Carter offered listeners a reflective style of jazz program music, one that contrasted strikingly with the heated swing sound that was on the brink of sweeping the nation. Only one of his compositions from this period, When Lights Are Low, has become established as a widely played jazz standard. But his body of work from the mid-1930s onward is a rich compendium of ingenious melodies, and singable ones as well. Unlike Duke Ellington, the other great ballad composer of the period, Carter's melodic writing